Hello and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I am your host, Luke Roadheffer. Joining me today is Shinar Atatürk, Akturk, an assistant professor of international relations at Koch University and author of the recent book published by Cambridge University Press, Regimes of Ethnicity and Nationhood in Germany, Russia, and Turkey. So before jumping into the interview, I was wondering if you could give us a bit of a biographical background on yourself and how you became interested in this topic.
Yes, sure. I graduated from the University of Chicago. I did my BA there, followed by a master's in international relations, also at the University of Chicago. Then I went on to study comparative politics at the University of California at Berkeley, where I wrote the dissertation that was the basis of this book, although that dissertation was revised significantly in producing this book. And then I spent another year as a postdoctoral fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, where I was also a visiting lecturer teaching comparative politics of post-communist societies for a semester in 2010. At that point, I left the United States and came to Turkey to start teaching at Koch University in Istanbul since July 2010.
Okay. And your book is unique in that it, I guess it's not so much unique, but it's interesting that it also uses archival research as well as interviews in three different countries. So can you talk a little bit about how long the whole writing process took, what archives you worked in, things like that?
First of all, Germany and Russia were interesting for me, going back also to your first question. Both as somebody who is interested in ethnic politics, but also as a Turkish person, of course, these are the two countries that Turkey trades the most, has the most intense relations, not just economically, but in terms of tourists and the human interaction, and also in a military strategic way, Russia for sure is the biggest geopolitical threat Turkey faced for the last 300 years. So there were these kinds of personal biographical motivations for studying Russia and Germany. And both Germany and Russia encapsulated a particular view of ethnic diversity and nationalism for me. When it comes to the logistics of doing the research, I spent about 13 months, an entire year, 2007, away from Berkeley, almost equally divided between these three countries. I spent three and a half months each in Germany, Russia, and Turkey. In all three cases, I divided my time between reading the transcripts of parliamentary debates on ethnically relevant issues, as well as trying to interview as many public figures from as different political opinions as possible in these three countries. If I were to assess the difficulty of getting an interview, I would say it was most difficult in Russia and the least difficult in Germany. You can see that actually pretty much in the appendix where I had the list of about 60 interviews I had. Half of them are with German officials. So I had as many interviews in Germany as I had in Russia and Turkey combined. And I was able to interview a member of the German parliament from each of the four large political parties. Also at the local level, in terms of the Abgeordnete House, the House of Representatives of Berlin, as well as the Bundestag, the federal parliament. In the German case, it was somewhat straightforward. sometimes as easy as sending an email to the secretary of the parliamentarian MP. In the Turkish case and the Russian case, I certainly needed referrals from people who knew these people. So what we call the snowball sampling. So I had to start with some people who already knew them, and it was somewhat more difficult. So, and you can see the results in the book. I mean, I have quite long quotations, either from parliamentary proceedings or from interviews I conducted in German, Turkish, Russian, and English. I did prefer interviewing them in English if they were fluent, just because of the risk of losing something in translation, because I had to translate all the interviews into English anyways in preparing the book. So, and that worked the best in the German case, where there were the most number of people who were absolutely proficient without a doubt in English, and it was the most difficult in the Russian case. And Turkish was not that much of a big deal either, because I'm a native speaker and I was sure not to lose any nuance even in full translation. So that's pretty much the summary of what I did.
Okay. So in your first chapter, you lay out a complex explanation for how countries are able to shift their policies towards ethnicity. And you use the terms monoethnic, anti-ethnic, and multi-ethnic. Can you explain quickly what each of these terms means in the case of your book?
Monoethnic regime indicates a state that restricts citizenship to one ethnic group only. And we have surprisingly many countries around the world that have privileged citizenship for a particular group of people. Germany is the case that I'm examining in my book. But if you consider the fact that even Kazakhstan, which is otherwise a very multi-ethnic country, has almost automatic citizenship for ethnic Kazakhs living anywhere in the world, mostly in Mongolia, China, Russia, Turkey, around Central Asia and the Eurasian steppe, shows us that the Kazakh state sees itself primarily as the state of the ethnic Kazakh. The situation is not much different when it comes to Japan, different only in the sense that Japan is already overwhelmingly ethnic Japanese, so by denying citizenship to non-ethnic Japanese, like the Chinese and the Koreans and other immigrants who are permanent residents of Japan otherwise, they are equating ethnicity and nationality. To a certain extent, the Israeli right of return is similar, granting automatic citizenship to any ethnic Jew around the world, but not to Christians or Muslims, Palestinian or otherwise. This shows that the state favors one ethnic group. Germany was the historic example of a monoethnic state, right? I mean, if the that's the topic of the book when it comes to Germany. How come Germany continued with the citizenship law of 1913, which granted automatic citizenship to ethnic Germans from Romania, from Kazakhstan, from Russia, from all around Eurasia, to people who did not speak a word of German in some cases, who have been living in Russia for over 300 years, at the same time that third generation Greek or Turkish immigrant children born and raised in Frankfurt or Hamburg or Munich could not acquire German citizenship as late as the 1990s. So that's the problem in the German case. So an anti-ethnic regime is one where the state does grant citizenship to multiple ethnic groups, but does not allow the legal, official, institutional expression of ethnic diversity. So in that case, the state is trying to assimilate a very diverse, ethnically diverse population into a national culture. Here, the metaphor would be the melting pot, which an American audience would very much be familiar with. Historically, the example of an anti-ethnic regime based on assimilation is France. Bretons and Occitans and Alsatians and all kinds of different ethnic groups who otherwise had their different non-French languages were assimilated into a French culture. Even though they were given citizenship, they had voting rights. So this is not Japan, this is not Korea, this is not, you know, some other mono-ethnic states. Finally, the third type is multi-ethnic, where the state does give, both gives citizenship to different ethnic groups and allows the institutional and legal expression of ethnic differences. What does institutional and legal expression of ethnic difference entails? Multiple official languages, ethnic territorial autonomy, ethnic affirmative action policies, quotas in bureaucracy, in various forms of employment, university entrance examinations. Soviet Union, historically, is a very good example of a multi-ethnic regime, and the Russian Federation as well, and those are the ones, that is the one. I take Soviet Union and post-Soviet Russia as one case, really, in the book. That's the historic case that I examine, but Lebanon could be another example, right, with quotas. Bosnia-Herzegovina, Canada, Belgium, with its bilingual, actually trilingual, complex ethno-federal structure would be an example. India, Nigeria. These vast multi-ethnic, multi-religious states based on ethno-religious federalism would all be examples of multi-ethnic statehood. And Turkey, in my book, stands for an anti-ethnic assimilationist state. So this is the brief summary of the three ethnic regime types.
Okay, and you also lay out a thesis that explains how these three countries have been able to shift their ethnic regimes over the course of the 20th century. Can you lay out briefly the three sections of this thesis?
You are right. The first chapter of the book talks about the typology of monoethnic, multiethnic, and anti-ethnic regimes, but the rest of the book is really about the transition from one ethnic regime type to another. Is it the case that countries, once they are founded as a monoethnic regime, stay that way for the rest of their existence? I don't think that is the case, although this is the prevailing impression one gets from reading books on nationalism and the rise of the nation state. And although I admit that it is rare for a country to evolve from monoethnic to anti-ethnic or from anti-ethnic to multi-ethnic, there are notable changes. And I took three such instances for examination in this book. Germany did eventually change its citizenship law of 1913 in the year 2000, and it did allow non-ethnic Germans citizenship. Turkey did lift the ban on minority language broadcasting and publishing finally, and minority languages with public funding were used in public television broadcasting and since 2004. And Russia finally did get rid of inscription of ethnic origins in individual identification cards in 1997, although it has been in place since the time of Stalin for about 65 years. How do these policies change? I argued that for states' policies on ethnic diversity to change, we need the coincidence of three factors. The first factor is that you need a government in power that has the support of constituencies with ethnically specific grievances against the status quo. To give a concrete example, Kurds in Turkey are a constituency with ethnically specific grievances against the prevailing official policy of assimilating the Kurds, not recognizing their existence and not recognizing their language as an official language. So any government, any political party in government that had the support of a considerable portion or majority of Kurds would be a counter-elite. I call these political groups counter-elites if they have the support of constituencies with ethnically specific grievances. But that has never been enough. You had in Turkey governments in power that came to power with the majority, with the votes of the majority of Kurds since 1950, but they could not change, they did not change the policy towards Kurdish, Arabic, and other minority languages since the 1950s. You also need a new ideology of nationhood, a new ideology that redefines what it means to be German and ethnic origins, what it means to be Turkish and ethnic origins, a new ideology that redefines the relationship between ethnicity and nationality. That's what was missing for most of German, Turkish, and Russian history, a new definition of Germanness, a new definition of Turkishness, a new definition of Russianness. Again, to make it close to home for an American audience, I would say probably the civil rights movement and the discussions of the 1960s and 70s redefined what it meant to be an American as well as being an African. And hence you had the rise of hyphenated identities such as African American, Irish American, Jewish American, Arab American, Armenian American, and so on and so forth. This kind of redefinition of what it means to be German, what it means to be Turkish, what it means to be Russian, did not take place until very late in the 20th century, which the book discusses. But even these two conditions together, that is, a new discourse about nationhood and counter-elites in power were not enough. These counter-elites in government had to have a hegemonic majority, usually in the parliament, but it doesn't need to be only the parliament, but at least in the parliament, they needed to have a safe majority. Why is that the case? I observed that in all three cases, state policies on ethnicity could not be changed with razor-thin majorities, with 51% majority. Why is that the case? Because these ideas of Germanness, Turkishness, Russianness are so entrenched in public and in politics, in bureaucracy, in the military, in academia, in the universities, that if a government tries to change this definition radically, it's going to face an opposition that goes beyond just the political sphere, that includes the bureaucracy, the military, the universities, the intellectuals, and so on and so forth. And in order to overcome that opposition, it needs a majority that is more than just 51%, because invariably, when governments launch such radical reform proposals, some members of their party start resigning in protest. And in order to withstand such resignations, such fallout from the reform proposal, they need a safe majority. Because if they have 51%, they are going to lose their majority very soon after they launch their reform initiatives. And that's what I observed in Germany in 2000, in Turkey in 2004, and in Russia in 1997.
Okay, so the first country that you look at then is Germany. And you note that the citizenship law that continued on into the post-war period was created in 1913. So can you explain a little bit about this law and how it essentially created a kind of mono-ethnic political culture within Germany?
The law of 1913, which predates National Socialism, the Nazi period, but which was kept during Nazi rule and even after the collapse of National Socialism for another 50 years, 55 years, conceives of German citizenship as the right, or rather the privilege, of ethnic Germans alone. And in that sense, and it used to be ethnic German men, so even the woman, there was also some inequality between citizenship passing from men and not women, but I don't deal so much with that in the book. But according to this definition, somebody who could demonstrate that he has ethnic German origins, but living in Manchuria or Vietnam or Kyrgyzstan, could acquire German citizenship upon visiting the German embassy in their respective country. Because Germany was the state of ethnic Germans. In contrast, because naturalization was almost impossible for non-ethnic Germans, it had a minimum 20-year residence, but also many other requirements, such as orienting yourself fully towards German culture and habitus, these kinds of details. The naturalization rate was much less than 1% per year. It was 0.1, 0.2%, 1 in 1,000, 2 in 1,000, because it was made extremely cumbersome for a purpose. German national community was imagined, constructed, not imagined, but institutionally, legally constructed such that it would be equivalent to German ethnic community. And that, of course, kept about 6-7 million permanent residents of Germany who were not ethnic German originally. And here we are talking about the millions of so-called guest workers who were invited to Germany after the Second World War to rebuild the country when it faced severe labor shortages following defeat in the Second World War. Here the largest groups are Turks, Spanish, Portuguese, Greeks, Italians, and later also various Yugoslav people such as Serbians and Croatians, and smaller number of Arabs from Morocco and Tunisia. And their combined population reached 10% of the permanent resident population of Germany, but they had almost no hope or opportunity to acquire German citizenship until the historic citizenship reform of the year 2000.
Okay, and in your discussion of the monoethnic political discourse that prevailed in Germany, you use as an example a speech given by the Christian Social Democrats, if I'm not mistaken, the political party that it makes a very interesting argument saying that America's and kind of the multi-ethnic system of ethnic policy is actually very flawed. I was kind of interested if you could expand more on what criticism and what problems they saw with the United States in particular and multi-ethnic policies in general.
Yes, the speech that you are referring to is by the CDU, Christian Democratic Union representative from Berlin in the Federal Parliament of Germany, in the Bundestag, in 1982. And that's Rolf Olderow is the parliamentarian, where he argued that, and I'm quoting from his speech, "When we glance at the United States, we notice that there too, big groups have not been integrated. People who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, those who cannot show these characteristics, are often not integrated. The tourists may like to rave about picturesque Chinatowns, but the politicians and policymakers record subcultures and cancerous ulcers such as the mafia in these slum areas of ethnic minorities, against which politics and administration have been fighting for decades, so far, unfortunately, without any success for the most part." And then he goes on and on talking about the disastrous influence of the Polish-American and the Greek-American and the Jewish-American lobby on American foreign policy, and how these ethnic lobbies are derailing American national interest in a way that is harmful to overall national interest. And basically, that's what Germany is hoping to avoid. Is what he's saying. It's again this speech, for example, that I quote at length in the book, summarizes the Christian democratic view of Germany. Right? I mean, in ethnic diversity, let alone religious diversity, because he also has not very flattering things about the Muslim minority among these immigrants, namely mostly the Turks and Arabs. They see in ethnic diversity a diversity of interests such that it would conflict with the national interest. So for the national interest to be coherent and without contradiction domestically, you need an ethnically homogeneous population, is the vision of Christian Democrats. And this is a representative from Berlin, one of the most multicultural cities. So you would imagine, if any, the Berlin representative of Christian Democrats to be somewhat more open to ethnic and religious diversity. What is surprising here for me, and I think maybe we can speculate as to why that is the case, is this Germany, Federal Republic of Germany, is established by the United States in collaboration with France and Britain. As you know, the British, French, and American occupation zones are united into the Federal Republic of Germany, and the Soviet zone becomes German Democratic Republic, Communist East Germany. And it is surprising that although all of the Western allies, France, Britain, and United States, have incomparably more liberal, ethnically blind immigration and citizenship policies, including France, which far more easily grants citizenship to Algerians and Tunisians and other Arab and non-Arab Muslim and Christian minorities that arrive in France, that are born in France. Germany resisted those models, even in the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way into the end of 1990s, because it was able to somehow preserve its historic peculiarity as a narrowly ethnic nation state. And it required the coalition government of Social Democrats and Greens, which came to power in 1998, to crack open this very narrowly ethnic conception of German nationality. And it actually took a concerted effort by the German government, where they had a public campaign, Ich bin ein Deutscher, I'm a German, spending millions of euros advertising non-ethnic German soccer players, TV personalities, and advertising them also as Germans, you know, some Turkish origin or Nigerian origin or Greek origin, German TV personality or soccer player or musician was advertised as a German, just to give communicate the idea to the German population that the definition of Germanness is being changed at the turn of the 21st century.
And you also talk a little bit about what happened in the decade following the major change to the citizenship law, particularly not only in Germany, but also in wider Europe. You have the publication of the book Deutschland schafft sich ab, so Germany is abolishing itself, as well as claims by the current government in Germany that multiculturalism has failed. So I was wondering of how you see these discourses as developing in the 21st century, particularly in light of the recent European parliamentary elections that gave the far right in Europe a significant increase in its representation.
All right. I would make two important points here with regards to the debate on multiculturalism in Germany, and as that relates to the greater European debate, because Germany is so central to the European identity debate. On the one hand, I think the shift from a narrow monoethnic conception of Germanness to an anti-ethnic one based on assimilation is done, and it is pretty much irreversible. Already over a million non-ethnic Germans have acquired citizenship. Actually, over a million ethnic Turks alone have acquired German citizenship, and thousands of Greeks and Italians and Spanish as well. And the German public now accepts more or less a Vietnamese origin leader of the Liberal Party, FDP, the leader of the FDP, Rössler, is an ethnic Vietnamese who was adopted by German parents during the war and was raised entirely as a German. Culturally so, in his accent, in his demeanor, in his everyday life, you would not be able to distinguish him from the majority German society, except for his appearance, which is the appearance of an ethnic Vietnamese from Vietnam. Similarly, the co-chairman of the Green Party is a Turkish origin politician by the name Cem Özdemir. So in terms of accepting fully assimilated non-ethnic Germans, Germany passed that threshold. What Germany did not become is a multi-ethnic, multicultural state. And that was a big mistake in the discussions in, 1999-2000, when the citizenship law passed. People hailed that as a step towards multiculturalism, not really. Because that citizenship law change, for example, made it impossible to have double citizenship for the largest group, especially the Turks. So they had to renounce any other rival loyalties and citizenships in order to become German citizen and German citizen alone. And that's not necessarily a step towards multiculturalism as it is towards assimilationism. Also, given the fact that Germany took an exception to the European Convention of Minority Rights and Minority Languages by saying that it will never recognize a minority language from former immigrants. So none of these immigrant languages, Greek and Serbian and Croatian, Italian, Spanish, Turkish, etc., would be recognized, not just today, but even in the distant future, as a minority language in the sense of the European Convention on Minority Languages. They didn't have to take that exception in signing the convention, but the fact that they did shows their fear of actual multi-ethnic, multilingual statehood. These fears are augmented when we talk about religious diversity, and especially religious diversity that has, as it usually has, public manifestations. When you consider the fact that there was an initiative in the German legal system, in the Constitutional Court, to criminalize circumcision. It was a case brought up also in relation to a Muslim citizen of Germany as a result of clearly a circumcision went wrong in the hospital, that the court basically took a decision to try the doctor who performed the circumcision for a criminal act of and this created a major controversy, of course, in Germany, not only, of course, for the Muslim community, but also for the Jewish community, for whom circumcision is a religious ritual, and especially given the history of German Jewry, this attempt at criminalizing circumcision was immediately taken back, and a religious exception was put in place. But there were, still are, attempts to criminalize a ritual animal sacrifice, which again leads to an immediate backlash from the Jewish and Muslim community, for whom kosher and halal meat has to have ritual animal sacrifice. And we can continue giving examples: ritual animal sacrifice, circumcision, the carrying of conspicuous religious symbols, whether that's a headscarf or a yarmulke. All of these examples, I have a few pages discussing especially these controversies, indicate that Europe has not come to terms with religious observance. It is coming to terms with ethnic diversity to a certain extent, but not religious observance. And I give an example in the book, a metaphor, what the real trial, the litmus test for multiculturalism in Europe is a Muslim Joe Lieberman. And by that, I mean a religiously observant Muslim public figure or politician who can make it in France or in Germany or in Italy, and so on and so forth, these countries that are having these controversies. Because for these publics to accept a completely assimilated ethnic Vietnamese or ethnic Turk who doesn't show any conspicuous sign of lifestyle difference in their everyday habitus is not that much of a tough test. The real tough test is going to come with religiously observant Muslims in particular.
So the next example that you, your next case study that you offer is that of Turkey. And could you first briefly give a just kind of sketch of what Kemalism means and kind of the ideology of that was espoused by Turkey's founder, particularly how it related to ethnicity and kind of the religious question within the Turkish Republic.
To sum up, the Turkish formula was to accept more than a dozen different Muslim ethnic categories: Arab, Bosnian, Circassian, Kurdish, Zaza, and many others, as Turkish citizens, with the condition that they assimilate into the Turkish national culture by learning and speaking Turkish, and preferably only Turkish, in the public sphere. And given that they do this, they did not face any barriers in the bureaucracy, the military, or politics. Hence, we have dozens of Kurds, Circassians, Arabs, Albanians who made it in Turkish politics, military, bureaucracy, as high up as president, prime ministers, ministers, high-ranking generals, chiefs of staff, and at every level. Now, the door of assimilation and door of Turkishness was shut from the very beginning to non-Muslims who became demographically marginal anyways, because already in the early republic the state encouraged their emigration, reduced their population to only 2% of Turkey's population, and continued encouraging their emigration and reducing their population further to around 0.1-0.2% of Turkey's population, pretty much negligible demographically today. So it's very difficult for you to encounter Orthodox Greek or an Armenian or a Jewish person anywhere outside Istanbul, but even in Istanbul, only very designated few neighborhoods today. So the real issue Turkish state policy faced was not with non-Muslims who were reduced to a very small number, but with Muslim ethnic groups, in particular Kurds and Zaza, which is a related ethno-linguistic group. They speak a language that is similar to Kurdish, so I am not a native speaker of Kurdish or Zaza, but people who are tell me that these are languages that are as similar as Spanish and Italian, so they are distinct languages, so we shouldn't automatically assume that Zazas are simply Kurds. No, they have their own indigenous language and culture that is distinct from the from Kurds. But these are groups, Arabs as well. I mean, there are at least 2 million, if not more, Turkish citizens of Arab descent who can speak or at least passively understand the Arabic language. So these Muslim ethnic groups, because they had citizenship, they had full voting rights, and they could participate in Turkish politics just like anyone else and assume positions in the bureaucracy, the military, and politics, they step by step over time voiced their demand to express their languages and culture in public without the fear of repression and assimilation. This was most pronounced in the case of Kurds, but also to a considerable extent in the case of an ethno-sectarian identity group known as the Alevis in Turkey. Alevis are a heterodox version of Shiite Islam. They are not Twelver Shias as in Iran. They are not Jaferis, the Iranian Shia, but it is a version of Shiite Islam that combines Sufi elements from Anatolian history. And they also are much like Kurds, at least somewhere between 10 to 15% of the population, so sizable population that can make a difference in national election results and can make a difference in national politics. They also voiced their demands to express their ethno-religious sectarian identity in public. And that's basically, I mean, Turkey's problem has been the problem of assimilation and the reactions that assimilation provokes. Whereas Germany's problems after 2000 were one of exclusion from citizenship and the reactions that this exclusion, this segregation provoked. And Germany overcame that problem more or less because it shifted to a policy of inclusion through assimilation, whereas Turkey is trying to grapple with the problems of inclusion through assimilation, because that's also not a fully satisfactory outcome for many ethnic minorities, Kurds being the primary example among these.
And the current government, which you discuss as being able to finally carry out this shift in the ethnic politics of the country, has garnered a lot of credit for carrying out a peace process and continuing a peace process with the Kurds and really pushing to offer them more autonomy with regard to their culture. Do you see these policies as still being successful in maintaining popularity for the current government?
I definitely believe that these policies worked to continue the popularity of the current government among the Kurds. My estimate is that at least half, if not two-thirds, of the Kurdish voters vote for the Islamic Justice and Development Party, which has been the one-party government in Turkey since 2002. So it has been the longest uninterrupted democratically elected government in Turkey's Republican history. It's a major feat and a reason, an important reason for this popularity is the fact that Justice and Development Party is more or less unrivaled among the Kurdish voters compared to the other national opposition parties. The only other party that gets the Kurdish vote is the Kurdish Nationalist Party, but that's more or less an ethnic regional party that doesn't have appeal anywhere else in Turkey, so it has no chance of being in government. It's at most it garners 6.5% of the national vote, and with that vote it's not going to be it's certainly not going to be the only party in government. It could in the distant future become a junior partner in a coalition government with a bigger party perhaps, but it doesn't have appeal outside. So the current government certainly does reap the benefits of legalizing Kurdish language, making it a secondary language in state schools, that's the middle schools and high schools, allowing publicly funded Kurdish language broadcasting since 2009. Actually, even since 2004, Kurdish has been one of five minority languages broadcast through state television channel TRT3, and since 2009, there has been a Kurdish-only TV channel, also fully publicly funded, a state channel. And all of these, and since 2011, Kurdish has been an optional language taught in public middle schools and high schools. And all of these steps were followed by unofficial negotiations, unofficial but pretty much publicly very well known negotiations between the current government and the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is recognized as a terrorist organization by the United States, European Union, and Turkey, of course, and the fighting between PKK terrorists and the Turkish military claimed the lives of up to 35,000 people since 1984, which makes PKK one of the longest-lasting and most violent guerrilla terrorist insurgencies in the 20th century. The only other comparable cases that come to my mind right away are the FARC in Colombia and Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. So the government has so far been successful in ending the fighting. So for the last couple of years, the death toll is in single digits, or at least at most double digits over a year, whereas in the 1990s, we had thousands of people killed per year in this fight. So in that sense, the government is successful. But what I did emphasize, and I think in that I may be first in the literature on Turkish nationalism and the Kurdish insurgency, the government's motivation in launching Kurdish language reforms and this multicultural opening is Islamic. That's why I label their policy as one of Islamic multiculturalism. The current government justified legalizing Kurdish, Arabic, and other minority languages on the basis of Islamic religiosity. They make very frequent references to the Quran and the famous sayings of Prophet Muhammad in arguing that ethnic and even religious diversity is a sign of God, and we have to protect this diversity because allowing people to speak their languages and practice their faith and their culture is a God-given right enshrined in the Quran and in Islamic law. And this appeal resonates with the overwhelmingly non-Kurdish Islamic electorate. And its crucial function has been to convince the non-Kurdish majority in Turkey to accept Kurdish language and Arabic language broadcasting and all of these reforms, which were unthinkable in the 1990s, 1980s, and before because of the strong Kemalist, secularist Turkish nationalism that was predominant for much of Turkey's 20th century history.
Okay, and the last country that you examine is, of course, Russia, and you do a good job of discussing kind of the foundational policies of the Soviet Union towards ethnicities and how they attempted to create, in Terry Martin's term, an affirmative action empire, but then they, by using a federative structure to give ethnic minorities rights. However, they ran up against a serious problem in the 1970s when they attempted to remove ethnicity from the passport of Soviet citizens. So can you briefly explain why the Soviet Union was not able to achieve this?
Right. In the beginning, the reason Stalin decided to write the ethnic origin of every Soviet citizen in their individual passports, which is the equivalent of an ID card for every Soviet citizen, starting in 1934, was to build the basis for ethnic affirmative action. Because one of the major promises of socialism in the Soviet Union and around the world was to end ethnic racial discrimination. So by promoting historically repressed minorities in the Soviet Union would give an important message to its own citizens, but also equally important to the rest of the world, that there is no ethnic or racial repression under socialism, that Kazakhs, Armenians, Azeris, Ukrainians have their own official languages, their own flags, their own ethnic autonomous territories, preferential treatment and affirmative action, favoring ethnic Armenians in Armenia, ethnic Azeris in Azeri, ethnic Tatars in Tatarstan, and so on and so forth. And that's officially, at least, the justification for building what, as you very well put in the terms of Terry Martin, the first affirmative action empire in the world. However, another unofficial reason for this policy was also to divide Soviet citizens along ethnic lines so that they cannot put up a common front against totalitarian communist dictatorship in the future. However, by the 1970s, smart communists like Yuri Andropov, who later became the general secretary of the Communist Party, the leader of the Soviet Union, but even before that, Khrushchev and Brezhnev, they saw that passport ethnicity in the ID cards was also a liability for the Soviet Union because it was feeding ethnic nationalism and potentially ethnic nationalist opposition against the Soviet regime. So they started thinking about removing ethnicity and instead just promoting the idea of a Soviet nation, which does exist in the literature. They very often talked about Sovietsky Narod, as I spend an entire chapter talking about Sovietsky Narod. It has been translated into English until now as Soviet people, but as I point out, based on other examples in Soviet publications, actually Narod was used equally as often as a synonym for nation. So this can just as well be called Soviet nation. And they were trying to promote this idea since the 1960s, increasing in the 1970s and 80s, because they were getting ready to potentially remove these ethnic identifiers, these ethnic identifications, and create a socialist melting pot. And that was really the end goal. Soviet policy was based on three stages. Rasvet, the flourishing of ethnicities, Sibliženje, the drawing together of ethnicities, and Slyanya, the merger of ethnicities into one big Soviet nation. But they could never reach that ultimate merger. Of course, there were groups, especially Soviet Jews and Soviet Germans, who were most discriminated by having their ethnic identities in individual passports. And the reason for that is because, for example, Soviet Jews were otherwise very educated, urbanized, very much Russified in terms of being absolutely fluent in the Russian language, and it was only the inscription of Jewish as their origin in their ID cards that prevented their upward mobility in society, in the party bureaucracy, and so on and so forth. So Jews, Germans, these kinds of ethnic groups without territorial autonomy, groups that did not benefit from ethnic affirmative action, rather suffered from ethnic discrimination, they advocated and demanded the removal of ethnicity from the passports, but they could not succeed, as the book demonstrates, I think, in quite detail. Throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, even under Perestroika and Glasnost and the first term of Yeltsin, only by the second term of Yeltsin in 1997, ethnic origin was removed from Russian ID cards.
Yeah, that's definitely the, I think, really, really interesting argument that you present there. And you also highlight a lot of facts that I think deserve a lot of scrutiny and claims, particularly on Andropov's plan that you discuss in some detail to completely rearrange the Soviet Union along economic lines instead of ethno-territorial lines. And so one last question on Russia is, was interested in what you see as the future for the ethno-territorial status, or the status of the various territories within Russia, and Putin's attempts to reform the administrative structure of the country.
I think post-Soviet Russia definitely made the transition strategic decision to transform Russian Federation step by step into a more assimilationist melting pot type of classical European nation state. Why do I say this? Because, for one, the key variable, the policy that I examine in the book, removal of ethnicity from individual ID cards, was, and it was interpreted by ethnic minorities as a step towards assimilation. For dozens of ethnic groups in Russia, who almost entirely lost their language, who are otherwise assimilated into the everyday life routine of the ethnic Russian majority, mentioning of ethnic origins in their ID card was the last reminder of their ethnic difference. I'm thinking of groups like the Komi or ethnic Jews and so on and so forth. So with ethnicity gone from the passports, in the next generation, we'll see the rapid disappearance, the rapid assimilation of these ethnic groups. That's one piece of evidence. Second, this was not some random policy decision. For example, Yeltsin also resolutely resisted having ethnicity in birth certificates at the end of his term. So this is part of a coherent grand plan, because Russian authorities also decisively refused Tatarstan, which was the most assertive republic in this sense, to voluntarily insert ethnicity in the ID cards, because we might understand the removal of compulsory ethnic origin inscription in ID cards, because some people might not want to have that. But Tatarstan led the charge among ethnic republics to at least have voluntary indication of ethnic, they call it also national origins, in individual ID cards. But the central government in Moscow did not allow that, and in fact said that's unconstitutional. So they stood against that. After Yeltsin, Putin came to power and he abolished the Minister of Nationalities, which was, yes, a Soviet legacy, but it also existed under Yeltsin, and its primary purpose was to highlight the fact that Russia is a multi-ethnic, multinational state with multiple ethnic groups together forming the Russian people. And by abolishing Ministry of Nationalities again, Putin actually gave the signal that he's not going to tolerate pride of place to the multi-ethnic nature of the Russian Federation. On top of that, Yeltsin actually changed the structure of the Federation. Putin changed, on top of that, Putin changed the structure of the Russian Federation. When he came to power, there were 89 subjects of the Russian Federation. When he left office for the first time in 2008, there were 85 subjects of the Russian Federation because he abolished four ethnic autonomous okrugs. And those were, of course, the smallest, weakest ethnic autonomies. I'm thinking that he started the erosion of ethnic territorial autonomy where resistance is likely to be the least, and that was the ethnic autonomous okrugs. So the next steps will be the merger and abolishing of more and more ethno-territorial autonomies. With the annexation of Crimea, which is the only ethnic Russian majority territory within Ukraine, Russia is again continuing on the path of assimilation in the sense that ethnic Russian majority is being emphasized more and more, and non-ethnic Russians are being asked unofficially but quite obviously to assimilate into the language and culture of the ethnic Russian majority. We see more and more references to Ruski, ethnic Russian, as opposed to Rossiski, inhabitant of Russia, in public speeches of leading politicians. And all of these signs are, I think, unmistakable indicators that Russia is making that leap forward or backward, however you want to interpret that, towards a more assimilationist, classical European nation states such as France or early 20th century Turkey by eroding forms of multiculturalism.
Okay, that was an excellent summary of the various, both your argument and the various case studies you offer. I think we're running out of time, but briefly, would you want to mention any of the current research that you're carrying out?
I am expanding on the same notion of ethnicity regimes. I'm concluding a four-year research project called Regimes of Ethnicity, a Global Survey of Ethnic Demography and State Policies Toward Ethnic Diversity and Religious Diversity. We have sent out surveys to experts of ethnic politics in every country with a population over 250,000 around the world. And I am compiling the results as a reference book, as a small encyclopedia of state policies toward ethnic and religious diversity from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. And hopefully that's going to be published in a few years. But again, the survey is ongoing. It will be completed by the end of 2014. And then hopefully in 2015, 2016, we'll start publicizing the results in the forms of articles and finally a reference book and encyclopedia of state policies toward ethnic and religious diversity around the world.
Okay. I think that's it for this interview. Thank you, Dr. Akçürk, for joining me for this interview. And I'd like to thank all of the listeners of the podcast, New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And I hope you'll join us again for the next edition. This is Luke Roadheffer signing off.